Erev Tov, everyone. Welcome to our annual side shear. Things are changing all the time, and what we hope to achieve this evening is to run through some of the halachos that are nogeya to living in this neighborhood more than any other. You wouldn't hear these things if you were moving into Forest Hills or into the five towns. But we'll stick to, let's say, the Eruv in our neighborhood, Kashrus in our neighborhood. And please, by all means, pick up some of your questions. I already took a few, and we'll have time at the end for these. So we'll start with the Eruv. Actually, I have here the outline of the Eruv. Of course, it's on our website. Become a member, you get a packet. This is in your packet. And it gives you the full boundaries of the Eruv. I just want to spend a few minutes talking about the history of the Eruv and what to do if you come in from another community and maybe you come from, they don't have an Eruv, or there's a smaller town, and you usually ask someone there about carrying here. And I just want to give just a little of the history of the Eruv that for some time was actually called a mechitza. The early in the 20th century, there were certain parts of Manhattan, especially in the Lower East Side, that had some natural boundaries that were already in place. Some poskim even allowed elevated trains, the side of an elevator train to be one side, and then you connect that with the Tzuras HaPesach to a fence along, let's say, the FDR Drive, and you connect to the tops of buildings, and this would enclose a certain area downtown. Other poskim decided that since Manhattan is an island, and there is a seawall around the island, an island is not enough to make something naturally bound, and in order to be able to halachically carry on Shabbos. In order for it to be considered an island, there has to be what's called Yud B'Sof Dalet. You have to have a wall of 10 tvachim that can have somewhat of an incline, about 47 degrees, that as long as you have 10 tvachim, about 45 inches, within a 6-foot drop. All right. But let's say the seawall is usually straight along the Hudson. Right, you go for Tashlich on 95th Street, or you go across the promenade there, you see there's a wall there into the water. The problem is that wall does not surround all of Manhattan, especially downtown by Battery Park City. There's shoreline there. Go look along the West Side Highway. You see there's not a wall there. The water goes right up to the shore. So whatever allowed Manhattan to be considered naturally Eruv material certainly no longer exists. So we have to artificially move in, or in addition to this, move in with certain designations. That those designations are called Tzuras HaPesach, where we string some wire along two posts. And it shouldn't be too long that a door made of straw would not be able to, or would just fall in by its own weight. So we connect these imaginary doors. Right? The door post is there. It's an imaginary door in the middle of it. And all those imaginary doors surround the entire city. And now you have your Eruv. 2 points. One is a sheet of the Chazon Ish, that if the enclosed area is already enclosed by walls in more than 50% of the perimeter, it's known in halacha as Omed Meruba Ala Parutz, the standing part, which can include, let's say, the Central Park West Wall, the fences along Riverside Park, other things of that sort, or possibly even inclines in Riverside Park that are certainly Yud B'Sof Dalet. If you have more than 50% in the perimeter that is standing, so that's what we would, that already turns the inside of that area into Rosh Hashanah and Derabbanan, to a Rabbinic prohibited area to carry on Shabbos. And then it's much easier to put up an Eruv in such an area. In order to satisfy, when we started working on this in the late 80s, in the early 90s, to satisfy certain opinions at Yeshiva University, Rabbi Schechter, Rabbi Tendler had a few words to say, and from his father-in-law. And we have a letter written by Rav Moshe in 1985, 1985, this is before he passed away, which was, this is just an interesting piece of scholarship, maybe someone will add this to a book someday. The letter has now, I've seen two forms of this letter. The letter has now it's Tav Shin Mem Ches. It's originally Tav Shin Mem Hey. I have the letter, it was his handwriting, his signature. That if Shimon Eider or other Gedolim would get involved in the Manhattan Eruv, he would put he would support it and he thinks it's a good idea, right? Why do I say it had two different dates? Because Rav Moshe died in Tav Shin Mem Vov. So those who think who want to show that it's a forgery say, how could he have written this? It was written in 1988, 2 years after he died. But in reality, the letter was written in 1985. And someone just, you know, connected the bottom of the hay to the roof and made it look like a ches. In any event, Rav Moshe made this claim that the right people got involved, so we were advised by the right people. In my recollection, it was Rav Avraham Marmorstein, who was the Rabbi of the Shul at the time, who was the first to come up with this idea of enclosing the west side. This has been done. There's an Avnei Nezer that speaks about this being done in Amsterdam. The end of the tshuva, he himself says he doesn't advise it. But this is what gave rise to this contraption that you see here. This, we made, at great expense, I must tell you, many of these to encircle the west side, where this opens up, right? And just it says a lot, it turns another 30, 40 times. And a big door comes out of here. Right? And it stretches across to the next one. And on the Wednesday night before Thanksgiving, we used to enclose the west side for a few minutes. So these were like dlosos, these were actual doors, not just Tzuras HaPesach, but actual doors that were what we call Re'uyin Linoil. Not that we don't actually close every night, but could be closed. And in fact, we did. Why the night before Thanksgiving? Because there's a parade the next day, and they're already, a lot of the west side was closed to traffic, and so we would just, in the middle of the night, take out all these orange posts, and close this. So if anyone wants to see it, you can uncover it, and you see what's inside. It's a very durable, it actually has Swiss cheese in it, but it's very, very brittle, this thing is about 20 years old, so I hope it's still, if you want to check it out, that's what it is. So that made the west side mechitza. It wasn't the west side Erev, it was the west side mechitza, in order to satisfy certain sheets. It's interesting, we took everyone's chumrah. Rav Shechter had a chumrah that this one didn't hold, and this one, Rav Eider had a chumrah that he didn't hold. But we really wanted to the best of our ability, cover all the bases. Yes, ma'am? Yeah, so just to connect the openings. Our original intention was not to include Central Park in the Eruv for what might be some obvious reasons. We felt that the Eruv was being established so that young parents could push baby carriages, and that the Tei Sefer Torah could be saved, Chas V'Shalom, in the case of a fire, but not to play Frisbee in Central Park. So when the east side was included, it didn't make sense to just have one Erev on the west side, one Erev on the east side. We just made it all across and just left out whatever was on the park itself. But originally it was, there are arguments you see all over in the Hamptons right now, that not keeping Erev in at all in a place because they don't want from Jews there. But our intention here was not to include an area in an Erev so that it would not lead to a zilzul of Shabbos. Right, so that continues to be our intention and contention about what the Erev should be. If you have to, a father has to wheel a carriage across the park to visit his wife who just gave birth, it's okay. So you have it for a baby carriage, but for some, yes. I have very careful delineations here. Indeed. Yeah, I think there was something with some construction that they were doing. The city didn't let us do that. Okay. The city wasn't letting us do. You see that there's a lot of construction in that area. Also, there's another very important point of the Eruv, and then I'm going to move on to the next subject, because the boundaries are very clear. Right? You have to go down to a hospital. If the boundaries are clear, but just one very important point. If you are in Riverside Park, right, and you're looking at New Jersey, right, and you don't see the highway, you should not be carrying there. Okay, got that? That's the simplest way I can put it. Okay, if you are in Riverside Park, you should be on the east side of the highway. Right? The highway is not at all included in the Eruv. There are some places in Riverside Park, especially as you go further down, where you can be on the, say, the Jersey side of the highway. Right? So you don't want to walk on Shabbos when you're carrying on the on that side. Now, there used to be a time for a number of years, and they just stopped doing it just because it was met with incredulity, perhaps. Is that every Thanksgiving Shabbos, the Shabbos after Thanksgiving, we announced that the Eruv was down, because the Thanksgiving Day parade forced us to take down the whole Central Park West part of the Eruv, right? And that was big tzimmis to get back within 24 hours. So we just said, you know what, let's leave it down. We'll have next week to put it back up. And we'll have the community, at least one Shabbos a year, get used to getting by without an Eruv. You know, kids growing up, they don't know that there's something called carrying on Shabbos. Right? You see, Gemara is in many places, Torah Shemitah, you know, certain dinim that we do, just so that people don't forget about the mitzvah itself. So we thought there was a good tikkun that people shouldn't forget the Torah of carrying on Shabbos. So now they say, well, since we took the Eruv clear across Central Park, it's a no-brainer. First of all, the north side, it doesn't touch the parade. All right, the south side it does. So there's one wire that has to be removed and put back, and that's done in a matter of moments. So certainly since we enlarged upon the Eruv, this has been the we have just made an announcement. The Eruv is back up, but I would tell you the following: on a day like yesterday, where it's really a storm, especially snow, on a Thursday or a Friday, one should not assume the Eruv is up. After all, there is an Eruv hotline. There is now it's a website. Just go here. No one should assume the Eruv is that the Eruv is up without going www.manhattaneruv.org. It's the website is on the front page there. Right. There was one terrible storm last winter, and while the halacha may be that if an Eruv goes down in the middle of Shabbos, there's a question of what you should tell the masses, right? Is you can ask a Gentile to fix it there on Shabbos, but certainly where there's reason to suspect that the Eruv should be down, you have to announce from the hilltops. You know, you should know that in a storm like this, the Eruv is likely to go down. So don't assume. Right, right. Look, there are a few times that the Eruv is down when we knew on a Friday, wow, everyone was getting 20 emails, right? Remember, everyone knew about it. And I said, so you assume if I'm not getting emails, I must be okay. All right, but here is a more difficult question, and I want to move on because there on every topic I'm going to discuss there'll be questions like this. You're inviting people to your house. You don't use the Eruv. That person uses the Eruv, and they bring you over some wine. They bring you over some challah. So what are you supposed to do? Or you're a guest at someone's house that doesn't use the Eruv. So I would just say, for that, use your discretion. You should, if you want to bring over something to eat, bring it over before Shabbos. All right? Even for people who use the Eruv, we should use it sparingly. If you have a doorman, leave the keys with the doorman. We should this is true on Yom Tov either. We should not indiscriminately carry. We should carry when we need to. Tzorach eis hadavar, right? So for this, I would say just use discretion. Bring the gift before Shabbos, right? If you don't use the Eruv and someone who does use the Eruv comes over to your house and brings over a gift, so these are actual questions. There's one Masechta in Shas that is filled with these questions. you're not going to guess it, perhaps, but it's Maseches Demai. Maseches Demai is all about questionable tithes. And that's really our source, of course, in Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi Gemara tells all kinds of ways to know how to tell if this person is reliable, how to tell if this, how not to make an embarrassment by questioning the reliability, how not to make someone feel bad if we're not sure if they're reliable or not. So really, Maseches Demai is the main sugya on this topic. And there, you know, when I say it, you know, it says if someone is, you have a standard, and someone who has a lesser standard, which in this case, we endorse the Eruv, we were involved in creating the Eruv. So we have a lesser standard of a particular thing. It's certainly a viable standard. But the person bringing it should, as I just said, understand, bring it before Shabbos. But that person isn't here at this shir. That person brought it already. And you're the one who you're in the shir, and you. So, I would just say, put it aside. You don't have to use it for that. There's an issue of bringing and making a kinyan on Shabbos altogether, right? One should not be giving over things on Shabbos unless they're needed for Shabbos, unless they're going to be used. Well, that's the assumption. Bring your wine; you can use it at this meal, right? So it's a sort of a catch-22. Right? You want to use it because you shouldn't be making a kinyan on Shabbos if you're not going to use it on Shabbos. But in this case, whether it's an Issa D'Oraisa or an Issa D'Rabbanan, the Yerushalmi in Demai says, if you have this standard, someone with a lesser standard, maybe just as much a viable standard, you hold from Rav Shimon, and this person holds from Rav Meir, and someone who comes to your house who's a student of Rabbi Meir comes over, and Rav Shimon said, okay, put it aside, and we'll have it after Shabbos. But I would say, I remember giving a shir here, this is 20 years ago. I think we just made reference to this shir. Just like this, I think it was one of these shir, Welcome to the West Side. And there was a Talmud of Rav Soloveitchik in the audience. And the Rav was very, very, very famous for giving out under certain circumstances. And it's not, you know, people have to understand what the circumstance was to allow a certain ran who understands a Yerushalmi about how to warm up food on Shabbos. Right? Now, it was very particular. People misunderstand what the actual heter is. The heter is that if the food was fully cooked and on the fire at the beginning of Shabbos, right, then there are certain leniencies about how to warm up that food the following afternoon for lunch. Right? So I remember saying that there are more paskins in the laws of cooking on Shabbos that one should not rely on this opinion. A, because many people will fail to realize that the food has to be on the fire at the beginning of Shabbos for this to work. The cooking started and was continued in the beginning of Shabbos. They'll have it in the refrigerator all through Friday, all through Shabbos afternoon, and then put it back on the blech. And the Ramah said not to do this. People will be mistaken. So I announced, listen, here on the west side, Kanai Nahara, right here in this room, are probably representations from 25 to 30 different communities. No? All with different expectations. You all want this shul to be like the shul you grew up in. Right? You all expect everyone else to follow the minhagim that you grew up with. So I said, you know what? In such a circumstance, it makes sense to take the highest common denominator when it comes to inviting people up. Because you don't want to have, you know, that this person had a rav where he gave a shir like this in Bishul. Every rav gives a shir in Bishul here and there, right? How to prepare food and warm food up on Shabbos. And my rav said that's cooking. Oh my goodness, is the food kosher? Right? So can I eat this? Can I eat here? So the answer, right, you could die, the Ran is could die, the Rishamli, Rav Soloveitchik is could die to rely on. So the Talmud of the Rav thought that I was, how dare you? You look at the Rav also. Speak against the kula that the Rav uses, right? So I just said, why should we have people wondering, is it warmed up properly? Let's just use the Ramah. The Ramah is codified. And use the Ramah's way of warming up the food. That's what I suggested. We should take the highest common denominator to the best extent we can. I must digress and remind myself of a phenomenal, this is such a musser, amazing musser. There's a person in our studying for Geirus in our community who asked to be invited right after her Geirus to someone's house for Shabbos. And she was trembling at Mincha. She came over to me at Shalosh Shudas. She was trembling. listen to this, it's a naivete, but listen to this tamimus. She said, at lunch, someone spoke Lashon Hara. Does that mean the food wasn't kosher? She thought, not that that chafed up the food, no. If someone could speak Lashon Hara at a Shabbos table, does that mean that they're not makdiv on kashrus? Imagine such a thing. It's a sign that the person is not careful with milchiks and fleishiks, but not with other things. If the person is so loose as to speak Lashon Hara, how can we be trusting of the kashrus at the table? It's amazing tamimus. Right? So, all right, there have been different tests throughout the ages of how to determine that a house is trustworthy. You know, when I have a community where you're checking here, and we're checking there, we're calling here, we're calling there, then we all start off with what's called the Cheskes Kashrus. We have an assumption that you went to yeshiva, you have a public persona. No one's out to invite someone else and ruin their halachic standing. By the same point, a chazaka can be ruined. You have something called a reisa. You go to someone's house, you don't see any mezuzahs on the doors. You say something. There could be something wrong here. This person thought Lashon Hara was a reisa, ruining the assumption of kashrus. Right? What ruins the assumption of kashrus? I saw a tshuva from Rav Yaakov Yosef at the turn of the century in New York City. He says that the deciding point is. Now, it's going to seem amusing, because how are you going to determine? You're going to ask that the woman who cooks the food goes to the mikveh, right? Obviously, in a married household. I won't go further with this. I know it's the West Side Shear, I know, but Rabbi Yaakov Yosef wrote. Others wrote that the husband wears dal kanfos and goes to mikveh. What can I say? If there are certain benchmarks that the person is doing this, don't ask everything. You don't have to ask any other questions in kashrus. In Maseches Tamai, in order to have a cheskes kashrus, an assumption that you can eat at this person's house with respect to tithes are much more serious than milchiks and fleishiks, and much more serious than tarfus, because A, they're much more complicated, and B, the punishment is much greater. It's much, much worse than a simple lav. And eating trumas meiser is a very serious infraction. Its nullification needs a lot more than 60, right? There are various proofs that tithing is much more serious. So in Maseches Tamai, what the person needed to do in order to eat at that person's house is actually make a public declaration. I hereby commit myself to tithe my food and give to the poor, give to the Levi, give to the Kohen. And unless that person does that, you can only eat at that house after tithing the food yourself. And the Gemara actually tells you how to do so secretly in someone else's house without being a ganav, and without, because you can't tithe someone else's food, you can only tithe your own food, without being a ganav and without embarrassing the person and embarrassing yourself. Right? So clearly the Gemara is concerned with not hurting any feelings, not doing anything awkward and untoward, right? So today, we have very easy assumptions, though the food is we have hashgachas on the food. I have to say, you know, people went to yeshiva, you know, everyone has a cheskes kashrus until you see what we call a reis. Until you see something wrong, we assume that there is a cheskes kashrus. Someone left me this question: when one is not sure about the kashrus of a host, how should one go about ascertaining the status? Or what does one need to worry about, and what can be assumed to be okay? So the main concern today is not so much tithing. Although if you do see Israeli fruits, you can ask a question: was this tithed properly? But it's not so common. But so tithing isn't the issue. The main issue is probably milchiks and fleishiks. Right? You assume that today if it's kosher, today it's glatt kosher. Anyone know any non-glatt butcher shops in the area? Everything is glatt kosher today. Question is going to be between milchiks and fleishiks. So you get an invitation. A new person moves in, and they ask. I have always found just to be straight up front and say, I just have concerns. But you know, look, what are you going to ask? You have two sinks? You can get by with one sink, right? So I've found you can take a blind invitation from someone you never met before. Might take some time. Just get to know the person. I think a little cheskas kashrus about the person davens, that the person has mezuzahs on the door. The person does. I know of two tshuvas. The man wears dal kantus, and then the wife of the family goes to the mikvah. Other benchmarks. You have to inquire. I want to have a community where we're kabdeu v'chashdeu, that we have yichoshed others. No, we're ksherim. We all have this cheskas kashrus. And I have a most important role a Rav fulfills is to answer questions. Right? I can always see from the questions a person asks where they are in their observance and in their religious lives. So on this, I would like to move into new apartments. This is always I get this question very much here in New York City. Is what do I do with the mezuzahs on the door? When I'm leaving an apartment, do I have to leave the mezuzahs up? So, if you've heard of this halacha, which is meant to protect the person moving in, who may not be inclined to put up a mezuzah, may not get around to it, or and I want to make sure that they're not lifnei ivel ositein mechshor, they put a stumbling block, but the mezuzah is there for you, right? So, however, now it's very much likely that after you move out, some building is going to take them down and destroy them. So, certainly, whatever this minhag is, right, does not take preference over the possibility, chas v'shalom, that these will be not just to put into Seamus, but to destroy it. However, if you know someone's about to move in, and the building the person is mamish moving right into your apartment, even then, one might possibly have to be careful because they always bring in the painters and they're going to do some work. And if you leave it up there, the painter may just take it down and again destroy it. Any chash that will be destroyed, keep it. However, this is a simpler thing. Remove them and make it available to the person. The whole point is that person should have it available so that the mitzvah is easy for that person to carry on. It's menschlich for that person to pay for it. That person does not have to pay for it, but it's menschlich because mezuzahs can cost $40, $50 a piece. You have six or seven of them. It's a bit of an expense. So that's clearly an issue. All right. With regards to moving in where there's an oven, a dishwasher, all sorts of issues with sinks and koshering, each situation is its own, but I would suggest if you have the opportunity to always put in stainless steel objects. You can get a sink that's stainless steel, even some dishwashers today are stainless steel. People ask, the person who lived before me was treif. Now I have the dishwasher there. They cleaned it out very nicely for me. Can I use it? So Rav Moshe, this is what I heard from Talmud Mutakim of Rav Moshe in Queens, that Moshe said that if it's not used for a full year, and then here's what I've heard, the two different reports at this point, and you change the racks, or you change the racks. In other words, if you change the racks right away, then you can actually clean it out very well with something caustic and run it through its cycle and then use it right away. But if you let it go a year without using it at all, then of course you have to clean it. But here's a caveat. Some older dishwashers have cracks all throughout the rubber. If you have cracks, it's no good. Murray uses, it's Lashon that says when you have that, though. Okay, good. Okay, excellent. So that you can, certainly seems so. If you have the crack, then the milkless inflation gets into that, and then it goes back out. It's not a good thing. What about using the same dishwasher? Keep it, because first of all, maybe a Gentile who's going to throw it away. It'll be a maybe a Gentile is moving in who will destroy it. Take it, yeah. You know what? My experience, when I go back to the old neighborhood in the Bronx, I see they actually don't take mezuzahs off. Gentiles like the mezuzah. They think it's good luck. Because I see some of those doors in the Bronx with three or four or five mezuzahs on the same post. On the right side, on the left side. And it's the little ones. You ever see those? They're painted over 100 times. Yeah. Phenomenal. Okay, anyway, back to here. Refrigerator doesn't... No, it's only for things that are hot that you have to worry about. So that the dishwasher, just I'll finish with this, is Rav Moshe never had a tshuva for individuals in their homes to use the same dishwasher for milchus and fleishus. There's a question about commercial use. I'm not going to get into that now because we're talking in our homes. And it's and that, now there was one last hotel that was using it for both in the mountains, and it doesn't even exist anymore. But it was never for an individual's home. Make it milchus, make it fleishus, one, but not both. Whatever you do in between, it's one or the other. Okay? So yes. Yeah. Technically speaking, yes, because it's only with heat that you have a problem. So if you're using it for something cold, the Gemara talks about using things for just storing fruit when it shouldn't be used for something hot. So yeah, that would be something that's acceptable. Okay, each oven has its own kashas now. By the way, the Star K has an amazing website of all the newest oven, the newest technologies for Shabbos, for Yontif, for kashrus, for kashering, for Pesach. It's amazing what's out there. Some of the other organizations have it too, but Rav Heinemann has really been working very much the last 10 years, even more, on the latest technologies for chagim and kashering things out. So if anyone has any specific questions, that's really an excellent place to go, and we found very detailed material. And if you're buying a new oven, look what's available out there. It's amazing things for Yontif. Yontif is usually a problem because some of the new ovens automatically turn off after a certain amount of time for safety reasons. But I made an Erev Tav Shil, and now it's not going to be on by that time, right? So that's and be careful also because a lot of the new stoves are ignited electronically, so certainly can't turn that on Yontif, because while we might consider electricity to be a type of Eish, it may even be molded Eish, but it's most certainly, according to the Chazon Ish, it's a type of binyan or tikkun, or it's more than just Eish. So while Eish is allowed on Yontif to be transferred, but we can't use electricity on Yontif because it's more than just that. Yes, sir. Let's just stay totally away from microwaves. I'm talking about Shabbos and Yontif. You're talking about kashering? Okay, so kashering a microwave is relatively simple. Whether for Pesach or for milchus or fleishus is it's probably wisest to use a microwave for one or the other. But if it's always covered, right? If it's always covered, and this goes in your office too. In your office, if it's a treif microwave, you have to cover it with two coverings, right? The food in its plate, one covering on top of that, another covering on top of that. Right, for milchus to fleishus, one covering will do it, right? But so it's a kosher microwave. Just put a bowl inside with microwavable bowl of plastic or glass, and keep it on. Shimonides says at 30 minutes, it's going to steam up, and whatever's in there is now not in there anymore. All right, so that's a simple way to do that. Okay, I would like to discuss hashgachos of restaurants here on the west side. And for this, we have our suggested list. I know people always want explanations of what gets on this list and what doesn't. So, and we used some of the criteria based on some experience that I have had as the head of the Midtown Father Kashrus the last 4 years that it existed, and our experience was not to give a hashgacha to a place that was open on Shabbos. Now you're going to say, wait a second, H&H Bagels makes bagels on Shabbos. And the fact is, so does Wise Potato Chips, So does M&M's makes M&M's on Shabbos. Those have nice OUs on them, and we eat them. We don't ask what he's made on Shabbos, what he's not made on Shabbos, right? Incidentally, I saw a sefer recently. It was actually the Rokeach on the Torah and on Chumash Megillos. On the front page it says, this book was printed on paper, not manufactured on Shabbos. Never mind, now, I'm not talking that the book wasn't printed on Shabbos. The paper that went into making the book was not manufactured on Shabbos. Ad kidei kach. The printer didn't print on Shabbos. The printer was a Frum company in Israel. But the paper they got, they even made sure the paper wasn't made on Shabbos. Anyway, the point is that... I think the wife is Jewish. The owner's wife is Jewish. And the store is in her name. But there's a big difference between, let's say, Wise potato chips that are made on Shabbos, or M&M's that are made on Shabbos, or anything of that sort, where there's a specific ingredient. They're not running out of that ingredient on any Shabbos of the year ever. They have a storehouse with rooms this size filled with chocolate, filled with sugar. They're not running out on Shabbos. But in a restaurant, you don't know how often in one day they run out of onions, they run out of garlic, they run out of tomatoes, they run out of salmon. There were too many people ordered this food, and during the day they're constantly sending out people to get more butter and right. So if you're here long enough, you remember there's a store. Well, it's still there now. It's called Carmine's. Carmine's used to be kosher. It used to be called the Pumpkin Eater. Remember that? Sam, you lived in that building, right? So down the block. Right. Right. So. No. We had Eshkacha. And it was. And he insisted on being open on Shabbos. It was a non-Jewish owner. And we tried it. We got the person was a recent ger. He needed work. So we said, okay, daven at Eshkacha minyan. You open the store. You sit there with a sefer. He sat there the whole day till Shabbos was over with a sefer, right? And he told us the experience was such a balagan. You're constantly violating the rules. Constantly, you had to really scream at them all the time. Well, there's no nachas in this. And this is what's happening with the mashgiach in the store. So it's so begging for trouble. If there's a restaurant that's open. And you know what? I have called Belafi to me. I said, listen, I want to come into the store. How often does the rabbi come by? Oh, he came by twice last year. Right? One of them was found with tray of cheese in the basement. So what am I going to do? If there's... I'm not saying that the Rav Machshir means harm. Just that there's too much money to be made. Why does someone in Muncie have to come to the west side and give Ashkacha? I'm not allowed to say it's not kosher. If I say it's not kosher, he'll sue me, and he has before. Not me, others who have said that. I can say it doesn't meet our standard of kosher. Right? In New York City, I don't want the government getting involved with definitions of kosher. Although they do, that store was fined for this being in the basement. Anyway, so our first and foremost, it's a store that is closed on Shabbos. However, there are exceptions. We make exceptions if the store is A, owned by a non-Jew. Rav Soloveitchik was very much vehemently opposed to shtar mechiros for Jewish-owned eating establishments. Soloveitchik begrudgingly allowed a shtar mechira for a business. You're selling luggage, and the biggest day of the week is Shabbos, so you sell the company to a Gentile partner for Shabbos. It's his company on Shabbos. It's your company on Friday, and you sell, and that's how it works, right? So Rav Soloveitchik begrudgingly allowed that for businesses of that sort, but not for eating establishments. That when it comes to kashrus, we should not allow a Jew to have a store that is sold for Shabbos. I know we're on tape here, I have to be careful, you know. But I do know that, I'll just say this. I went through a great effort. Across the street from that store is a firm owner, through great efforts attached to the craft store, through great effort to convince that person to stay closed on Shabbos. And he did. Right, you know what I'm talking about? It's attached to the other store. It's open a little on the side there. But he's not selling stuff on Shabbos there. He wanted to. And the Rabbi Machshir was willing to let him. But I said, listen, right near my shul, I don't like places like this open with kashrus in the window, open selling on Shabbos. It's just we worked so hard for 20 years taking this out of our community. And now, I don't know. I just know that person went through great effort. I convinced him. He lives in Flatbush. He comes by here sometimes. And he closed on the Shabbos. I don't know anything. I wasn't contacted about this other place. I don't know. Yes. I say the same. Sorry. Dunkin' Donuts. Because a store like that is also not... I think that's different than H&H Bagels. It's not the same. H&H Bagels has a specific ingredient. I think there are two categories. H&H, the Wise potato chips and things where they're serving food and they're making it, maybe putting things together. If all they're doing is making one set item and putting the sesame seeds on top and putting the garlic on top of it, they're not running out of these things. And it's never going to never happen. I think they're also serving other things there. Right, but anyway, that has been our stand, and that's why it's not on this list. I just want to explain the list. So here it is. Okay, I'll take two. Is there any questions? Yes? I think there could be a system whereby you keep the place open on Shabbos and the Mashkiach walks in at unannounced times. If that's the case, it's possible that we tried that. We tried to keep the Mashkiach in the store all of Shabbos. So if it's something where there's a set ingredient and Wise potato chips, M&Ms, everything goes in, they know what's going in, there's no question. So it's very reliable that they're not going to all of a sudden on a Shabbos, while the Jews aren't looking, put in pork drops into the potato chips or into the H&H pages.
But when
in that other place,
yeah.
Right? When he was showing us this problem, we dropped him. No, but during the rest of the week, if he runs out, he's not supposed to add anything to the store on Shabbos, right? And so the rest of the week, there were if he runs out, he can give a call, the Jews can answer, we can help him get it. But Shabbos had its own special issue. I was referring to Cafe Viva before. Yes. I don't think so. No. I'm saying. I can't say it's not kosher. I could say it doesn't reach our standard. Okay, but that's. Okay, all right. So let's talk a little about doormen and the parameters of keypads and other things like that, where they know to get into your building. So Rav Moshe Strombach has a whole kuntris of tshuvas on this from South Africa, when he was still in South Africa. It's very good to see the tshuvas. They're very politically incorrect about why they need doormen there and what's going on. But I ain't shocked. They were written back in the 60s. Anyway, so he says that if you live in a place where they buzz you in, because they buzz in everybody. Doorman sees someone come up to the door, he buzzes. So, in effect, what's happening to your door, Moshe Strombach argues, is just that there is an open door. There's a magnet that just pulled across a lock. Now you have a door to open. You don't have to refrain from opening that because he's pushing a button for you. Because he does it for everybody. If he only does it for the Jews, it could be something to talk about there. But since he does it for everybody, then Moshe Strombach argued that's okay. It's brought up to a daita d'nafshei. Here's the general principle: a Gentile cannot do for us on Shabbos what we can't do for ourselves. I know that's going to sound harsh. You go into an elevator and you press the 17th floor, and you're going to say, "How is he doing that? If you can't press 17, how is he pressing 17?" The answer is because he's going to 17. Right? Nah, he's not going to 7. No, first of all, there are very few operators anymore. But even if there is, he's only going to 17 because of you. If he's going to 17 because of you and another person who's not Jewish, by the way, then you can go in with that person. So he's doing it for someone else, he's doing it for himself or another Gentile. You can derive benefit from that. But if he's doing it only for you, it's a Beferish Gemara in Masechet Shabbos and in Masechet Beitzah. Shmuel was reading a sefer in a very dimly lit room on Shabbos. A Gentile saw him. The Gemara doesn't say whether the Gentile knew him or not. Doesn't matter. The Gentile saw him and lit a fire for him so he could see. And Shmuel said, "Oh no! Now I have to leave the room." Right? And then he saw that the Gentile walked in himself to read some contracts, and he said, "Oh, Adaita the Nafsheka Ovid. He did it for himself. Now I can come back into the room." That's it. Even if he didn't know him, he just did it as all right. The guy can't read. I don't know. I guess let me do him a favor, right? So it's as simple as that. So I saw it. Where did this come from? There are places where you use an elevator. You go way up to a high floor. All right, maybe it's a Shabbos elevator. Here is the basic answer, is that this gzeira called Amira la'akum shvus, that a Gentile either telling him or him just doing it for you, unless he's doing it a daita d'nafshei, is an issur d'rabbanan. And for some, there's a Tosfos in Masechet Shabbos that says if the alternative to having this Gentile do this for you is that you're stuck in your house all of Shabbos because you're 95 or because you have a broken leg or whatever else it is, then you can rely on this. Don't ask him. Tell him before Shabbos, so he knows, he sees you, he presses 23. Fine. I don't know whether a person is doing moving into floor 23. I don't know, but all right, but that was the only chance, or that's where that's Baal Tshuva. He became from after being there. So that if the choice is, I've had it here. I remember Shimon and Erna Meyer. They lived for over 50 years on 92nd Street. And when they got to be about 93, he said, "I can't." They lived on the 6th floor. "I can't walk up anymore. Can someone press the button for us?" So I said, you don't have to be cooped up in your house all Shabbos. Shabbos is misery. You have to stay in your house all Shabbos. There's no tzorach gogol mizu, says Tosfos. So all right. So for that, perhaps we understand. But otherwise, so you have an invitation on the 17th floor if you're able-bodied. So it has to be that he's doing it for himself. I mean, that's the simple Gemara. And it's a Gentile who sees you in there and says, that you certainly do. I'll get off where you're getting off. Well, they know you, and they know you keep Shabbos, and they press your button, and... Same as you, and you know, wherever you're going. I'll just follow you to your apartment. It's not so simple. It's just I'm just using the Gemara I just mentioned with Shmuel. "Oh, I have to leave the room now because you lit it for me." Well, how did these lights get on Shabbos? They're not left on all Friday night. The guy comes in the morning to fix some siddurim, to fold some talit, do something in the room. So he wants to see well with it. We can stretch it a little, obviously. You know, it's for me. He did it for himself, right? And if he's just doing it straight out for you, it has to be le'ezet tzorech to undo this drabana. Okay, I'm going to go sweep in this direction, but yes. That's starting to get into what Rav Moshe Sternbach said, but it's a little different. His tshuva was just to press the button and everyone goes the same thing. Here is it's a different floor for every person, so it starts to become something special for you more than just what we call a daita d'nafshei. It's a mitzvah to malamed zchus. It's a mitzvah to malamed zchus because a lot of people, it's a makubal, a lot of people doing it. What did I say? I remember hearing from a Soloveitchik this exact issue. He complained. He said that it's... If you're able-bodied... he's doing it. There's something for him to gain. He's hoping that the person in the building will, the apartment where you're going, will look kindly on it over the years. But I still stand. Yes. Let me just step to something with the elevator, and I'll come back to it. And I'm not giving another shiur shortly, so I'm excited to realize we're going. So much more here. Yes. It's an excellent question. The Gemara asks this question. So the Gemara says that when it comes to heating and cooling, that's already one of the things, like that 93-year-old couple that we said, heating and cooling so you don't catch cold, you don't get overheated, and someone who's a heart condition doesn't, is one of the things that allows that this is rabbinic in nature, right? We wouldn't allow a Torah, chas v'shalom, not a Torah law. It's rabbinic in nature, so we relax certain rabbinic prohibitions in the face of, we have to be very creative in some cases here, because some buildings, you're trapped in the building unless, you flash a card or something, or just opening the door even from inside releases some kind of... so you have to wait for someone else to walk out with you. You have to. So here we have to be creative. I'm not going to go through all the lum this year with grama psikreish de lo nichole, together with this kula about being trapped in your house all Shabbos. So if anyone has that particular issue, we can raise it. Yes. Right, so that's probably two of the things I just mentioned. It's certainly a grama. I mean, it's sort of a koach of a koach of something else, and it's probably a psikresha de lo nichalei. Although you might argue that noise prevents the door from hitting you, right? The door's not going to close on you when you're walking through. So it might be certainly a davar shenei miskaven. You're not intending it, right? Question is, it's a psikresha. It's certainly going to happen. But then again, it's not something that you're looking forward to or expecting something to help you. So that's another reason why I would say not to. I know in my building, that's exactly what happens. People walk in here, walk in for three or four people. It's an annoying little thing. But yeah, if you're able-bodied. Oh, this is a nightmare now. I know. It's a real nightmare because you want to avoid the elevator problem. You have a bigger problem because you're turning on lights all the way up 17 floors every little floor you go on and the light comes on. So I have written a number of letters. I just went through a great, great effort in Los Angeles for someone, a member of the shul who's on sabbatical in Los Angeles, to get the owner of the building to shut it off just for a few hours Friday night. Wait till they get home from shul. And then sometimes they have a guest. We've made an agreement by 10 o'clock, we're home. If we're not home by 10 o'clock, all right, well, we'll climb up the window or something. In other words, a person with great effort, they found out a little anti-Semitism. You people, you're so pushy, right? But it's not so simple. We are pushy because we have all these pushy laws. What can I say? But it's part of our holy observance. But Enichanami, so what do you do if you have such a circumstance? I don't have any quick answers for this. It might be simpler to just take the elevator. Right? Especially if it's a... Right, and I think they the lights stagger. Every floor, another light goes on. It's crazy. Even when you walk up or walk down, any time it senses something moving, bang, it's going on. So, I mean, it's not such a simple thing. But you know what? We're pushy. We try to get the buildings to say, okay, listen, just from Friday nights from 6 o'clock till 10 o'clock, leave the lights on. And they're gonna come back to you and say, doing that for 52 Friday nights a year costs us an extra $200. Okay, let all the front people in that building pull it together and say, keep it on Friday nights. The Jews have totally turned over this whole area of the West Side in terms of what these landlords can charge in rent anyway, right? If no from Jews from 86th Street and above, then they wouldn't be able to charge half of what they're getting. So maybe too late to remind them of this, but we can tell them, you know, do us a favor here. So if anyone knows, if you know of such a building, we've written such letters, and some have been very, very forthcoming. There were buildings that wanted to make only electronic entrances. Remember the Key West, the Westmont, they agreed to have one door on the side that wasn't electronic. First they wanted to make it all electronic. So, all right, we have to take one by one. I think I'll take this last question on this topic, if I may, and I'm already a little late for my next year, and I just wanted to conclude with one last thing. That might be a new thing. I remember making research into this, and we even called some elevator mechanics to say that that works on the way down, but not on the way up, strangely enough. But not on the way up, but on the way down. The way up, it imagines the most weight possible. On the way down, it does change based on the weight. But that's what I heard. So most of the people that are in question is going up. Because on the first floor, it's a given, it's going to be here. On the 17th floor, you're going to wait for it to come, and then just sit there, and until it probably will go down to the first floor at some point soon. Right. Right, yeah. Okay, I just have one last thing, which is it's really crucial. Please, this is so important here. I have so many cases of this. When you move in with roommates, especially roommates that you don't know too well, put every agreement in writing. I know it sounds it sounds like, well, why do I have to negotiate this person? We're getting along so well. All right, look, you know, I actually put something in writing when I got married. I gave my wife a ksuva. When you go in with a roommate, there's some marital aspects. You know, we're going to be sharing food. So we should put things in writing. The most obvious thing is where we're on the lease together, or maybe only one name is on the lease. But what happens if one of us, Baruch Hashem, we meet the right person, and then we're getting married right away, and we have to cut out 3 months before the lease is up? There should be a reasonable agreement, as long as it's an agreement before, that I have to find a new person so that you're not stuck paying a fourth of the rent with no one here. You know, you have to have the reasonable expectation. And most of the arguments I've seen is that the guy is saying, oh, I'm trying so hard to find a replacement. And they say, no, he's not. And he leaves and he says, what can I do? I didn't find someone. And they're stuck with another rent. Right? So the expectation is, I will try, and if I don't get it, I'll pay the rent until I find that person. Or whatever agreement they choose to make. Right? So, but have something. I'm not saying you have to have a lawyer, Dafka, write it up, but at least have an agreement that's in writing. Too many times I've seen people say, we did have an agreement, and they said, that's not the agreement I thought. If it's in writing, and you all sign it, it's there. Okay? And that agreement should have certain things, and even put this in writing. Put this in writing, is that we agree that we're going to follow the laws of Yichud in this apartment. We're going to follow the reasonable expectation of what we do on Shabbos in this apartment. We can't have that. You know, this one brings in this all kinds of things in the apartment that are just antithetical to what another person has. That we have an expectation of what kashrus is. Look, it's an issue. I'm sure with the feet tumeich, you heard that this hashgacha is good. Has to be, you know, everyone in the apartment can say, well, this is our list, only from this list comes into the house. There's something, you know, for only OU, OK, Chavke, these 467 Hashgachas, you know, and that'll be fine. But it's a recipe for if not disaster, for ill will if we have different expectations in the room. And I think that should be. And I always, as I started, my first point was to try to take the highest common denominator. And I've been the Rav now here 25 years, if you can imagine such a thing. But in a community where I do understand, where if you ask the average person, where do you want to be in 5 years? Many people will say, not here, right? And good, that's right. We should all be in Eretz Yisrael in 5 years. Not Teaneck, Eretz Yisrael. But while we're here, let's make the best of everything. Let's put everything we have into making this a good stay, a meaningful stay, a ruchniyah stay, and one that will help us become responsible balabatim wherever we end up from here, wherever we move from here, that we move on. So, Bezus Hashem, we will all meet that role. Please God. Nachum, I'm not taking your question privately. I'm already late for the next year. Okay, shkoyach, everyone. Shkoyach.